This is from my new novel, and it's set in 2047, and the character here, there's an imminent war that the U.S. will be involved with. It's set in Dayton, and it's a war over food and water. And Turo, the character in this section, is a church custodian. The pastor waved Turo to a chair, then sat behind his desk and abstractedly tugged at his ear. "Tell me, did you have any bread left over from the Palm Sunday potluck?" It was almost July, and Palm Sunday had been in April. Did the pastor think Turo's memory was that good? It had been a cold spring with several late snows. The weather experiments of the early 30s had, as an unexpected side effect, resulted in old-style winters and hot summers. It often snowed by Thanksgiving. "If I did, I fed it to the birds." "That's Christian, I suppose, our brethren birds. How about after the Easter reception? Tequila Huntington said there was a whole sponge cake and half a loaf of Ukrainian lemon bread in the cupboard by the fridge." Maybe it was his race or his temperament or some forgotten trauma of his childhood, but Turo was always steeling himself for news of what he had done wrong. It made him cringe to think of himself as cringing, but there it was. And he did do things wrong, didn't he? He wasn't perfect, although there were moments, turning to inspect the Sunday school room classrooms before he switched off the light, he felt he was. "Are you the janitor to the bathrooms?" someone would ask, and Turo would freeze, wondering what he'd missed. "That's the cleanest bathroom I ever seen," the person might say, and Turo would be flooded with gratitude and relief and, yes, surprise. His face would light up in what he knew was a rewarding way. He got hundreds of compliments. He was a kind and conscientious man, and he did his work well. But he could never quite believe that people would praise him and not find the fault. So when someone found a fault, Turo accepted it. Hearing he wasn't perfect was almost a relief. I didn't see any extra food at Easter," he said now. "Maybe I should have." "There's some things missing," the pastor said. "A sterling silver plate, and Jip Cooper brought a cut glass server." Turo shook his head. I'd remember those, I think. I'm pretty sure I didn't." "Well, that's too bad. No one hanging around that night? No intrusive interlopers?" The pastor used phrases like that in sermons: fair-weather Philistines, complacent Christians, reductive religionists. He would never believe that Turo, listening from his station in the supply room behind the pulpit, would recognize them as the vacant phrases they were. "No," Turo said, that he was sure of. "Too bad." The pastor waved his dismissal, and Turo was already to the door when the next question came. "Have you checked the narthex lately?" The narthex was the anteroom at the back of the sanctuary where people stood and gathered before and after the service. Turo remembered starting this job and not knowing what a narthex was. Now his chest tightened and his tongue felt too big for his mouth. What else had he done wrong? I cleaned it Sunday after services." "All of it?" "I was there to pick up some hymnals, and I noticed some brownish streaks on the cupboard beside the front door. Low down. Isn't that strange?" I thought. "Turo doesn't usually miss things. See? You have us spoiled." In the narthex, the late afternoon sunlight patched the hot and humid air with pinks and greens. The narthex was separated by a wall of stained glass from the sanctuary. At one end of the narthex, where Turo entered, a hall led to the church classroom, social hall, and offices. Once upon a time, the whole sanctuary narthex complex was air-conditioned all week, but now the energy was more than anyone could afford. To get some air, Turo opened the big front doors, glancing at the lower cabinets as he passed them. Brown streaks. The pastor was right. Turo flipped the overhead light on in the narthex and walked down the side aisle of the sanctuary to the maintenance closet, where he filled his wheeled bucket with water and soap and rags. "Fastidious boy," his Aunt Stella used to call him. Back in the narthex, Turo squatted. A whole wall of oak cupboards flanked the front door, their shelves filled with hymnals and prayer books, a ledge separating the cupboards into lower and upper sections. The hymnals kept in the bottom cover were the old ones, rarely used. And it was on the doors of these cupboards, inches from the floor and running horizontally, that Turo examined the series of brown streaks. He swiped at one with a wet rag. Naomi, his ex-wife, had had terrible periods, dripping out of her and onto the bathroom floor. The reddish-brown on Turo's rag looked familiar. Blood. Not dripped, as if spilled from someone. Not beside a doorknob, as if someone had scraped a hand. But low, on a cupboard, a thing a person wouldn't brush against at that level. And going on for inches, no, feet. maybe 3 feet, as if a bloody something had been dragged alongside the wood, although there were, Turo checked now, no spots of blood on the floor. Turo stood and shut the big front doors. Turo knew what he expected when he opened the cupboard. So much violence since the gritting, so many refugees, people stripped from their surroundings and turned casteless and angry, unfettered by grandmothers and neighborhood police and people who knew their names. The troublemakers were largely young males. The other day, a woman's body had been found wedged behind a door at the public library. Instinctively, Turo pinched his nostrils as he opened the cupboard door. It was a boy. A small Milano boy, not more than 5 years old, curled up in the cupboard facing out as if he were simply hiding, his nappy head tucked down to his chest. Turo touched his shoulder, cold and stiff. He wrapped his arms around the small chest and unwedged the body from the cupboard, slipped it on its side onto the floor. The boy's face had a pleading, confused look. Turo felt for a second as if he were looking at himself. Turo's clearest memory of his mother were of her shoes, a blue pair with suede appliqued sea stars, an olive-green pair with seams stitched in a yellow zigzag. His mother liked to scoop Turo up so his legs dangled, a lilac smell. After she was shot by the man Turo called uncle, Turo was raised not by his father, no one was raised by a father, but by his great-aunt and his grandmother, Tati, who lived together in a welfare department that was actually Tati's, where Turo had to scoop his toys and himself under the bed when the caseworker arrived, because children were not allowed. The great-aunt had an ex-sister-in-law Turo was told to call Aunt Stella, who lived in an apartment down the hall. "To whence are you headed, little man?" she might ask. "To whom are you carrying that candy?" A stickler for grammar. She had what Turo later learned was an erect carriage. She always stood high with her neck extended, like an African queen, like a Zulu, she said. Turo could be a Zulu, she liked to point out. That height and those high, wide cheekbones and almond-shaped eyes, really a remarkable-looking people. People who adopted Milano boys got subsidies from the state of Ohio because people didn't want to adopt Milano boys. That adopting you should require bribery is a tragedy and a crime, Aunt Stella said. I couldn't be sure which it is more. But she and Turo would live better if she adopted him. They could leave this ill-kempt building with its slovenly occupants and rent a house with a yard and honeysuckles edging the back fence. A back door as well as a front one, 3 steps up the yard into the kitchen. They would be a family. Turo could call her mom. Would he mind calling her mom? Or would that be hard for him? I could call you mom, Turo said. In her dream of how it was, she indeed adopted him. They moved to their little house in Englewood. Turo went to a good school and wore a uniform. When he got off the bus each afternoon, Aunt Stella was waiting by the fire hydrant. They had a dog. They barbecued in summer. Turo spoke correctly. No one stomped on anybody's heart. It had been, in its way, a terrible childhood, not because he was unwanted, but because after his mother's death, he was wanted too much by 3 aging, angry women who each had their own purposes and plans. Turo remembered sitting on the brown plaid couch at Taddy's, eyes darting from face to face as he tried to figure out what they wanted, to whom he should acquiesce, to whom he should say, to whom. Now in the narthex of his place of work, Turo saw in the dead boy's face the same confused pain that he had felt, and all Turo wanted was to make it end. He picked up the body and carried it to a supply closet behind the pulpit, which no person but Turo ever entered, cleared a space on the bench against the wall there and set the boy down. He could not get the boy uncurled. There was a wound in the left chest, a complicated thing with congealed blood mixed with torn fabric, an area he would have to clean, Turo knew, but for now something he chose to ignore. There was a streak of dried blood coming out of the right ear. Turo turned the light off in the supply closet, stood outside it praying the Lord's Prayer for himself more than the boy, then closed and locked the door. He took a bus home. He left his apartment with a duffel bag full of supplies, remembering even the hat to cover the wounded ear. He took off the boy's clothes and, starting with his face, washed him with a washcloth scented with cologne, cleaning off every part of him, even the bits of blood next to his wounds, which must be knife wounds, in his chest. As he worked, he dried the boy with his fluffiest towel. Inside the boy's shorts, there was a surprise, dried stains of urine and stool and blood, which wasn't right, which hurt Turo in his soul. He said the Lord's Prayer again, left the body on the bench, the towel draped carefully over it, locked the door, and took a bus to K. Bob's East to buy clean underpants, carrying the soiled underwear in a paper bag, which he dumped in a bin outside the store. He bought the best children's underwear they had, boxer shorts in red silk with a black waistband. He returned to the church, finished the washing, oiled the body, especially over the knees and elbows where the skin was ashy, dressed the boy in the boxer shorts, and wrapped him in a red and green and black scarf Naomi had once given him for Christmas. Toro then shut the door to the closet again and walked to the social hall to get wood for the coffin. Toro went through the planks of wood stored at the back of the stage. No one would miss a few boards. It was evening now, but still light out, and Toro checked the parking lot through the window to be sure the pastor's car was gone. Making a coffin would involve banging. Toro knew his boss's habits. Unless there was a committee meeting, unlikely in the summer, the pastor would not be back during the evening. By the time the boy was nestled on his side in the coffin, the lips over his broad white teeth oiled, a drop of cologne placed in the indentation below his nostrils, the city was almost dark. These days there were fewer and fewer lights at night, and Toro wanted to have the burial before he couldn't see. "Goodbye, my son," he said, kissing the boy's forehead, and then he hammered the board into the coffin's top. It was sad to no longer see or touch him. Toro thought of the boy's puzzled face, his long fingers and slender wrists. He dug a hole in a bare patch behind a prickly shrub in the church garden, a place Toro had never liked much. The volunteer gardeners were lazy, but one that would have to do. The hole was maybe a bit sloppy, not quite deep enough, but every minute it was darker and Toro wanted to be done. Beads of sweat dripped from his nose. He laid the coffin in the hole and shoveled dirt on top of it. The hollow thuds echoed like cannon shots, the worst sound in the world. Another prayer. But where was the service? The boy deserved the service. "Why am I creeping?" Toro thought. "Why don't I put the lights on?" But he was creeping, without the lights on, through the narthex and past the social hall and in the classrooms and into the pastor's office, a place which, for the sake of cleaning, Toro had a key. There, Toro closed the curtains and put the light on. He went through the pastor's computer index, then his bookshelves. The books of Presbyterian liturgy, seasons of life, today's rituals for today's times. He finally found the service he wanted, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, within a book with a broken spine that made him sneeze as he leafed through it. He took the book outside and with a flashlight read the entire service over the grave. If someone saw him now, so be it. Toro was doing his duty. He replaced the book in the pastor's office. Then, because it was too late for the buses to be running, Toro walked the 3 miles home. Toro bolted awake in the middle of the night, but he has a mother. A cold sweat washed over him. He got up and stood over the toilet. So what if Toro didn't have a mother? So what if other women, not his mother, fought over him? Why in the world did he assume the same about the boy? The boy who was just a boy, maybe 4, maybe 5, who lay now in the dark, warm ground. Of course the boy's mother, his only mother, his true and real mother, was frantic now looking for him. Toro dressed and ran back to the church, his left little toe sore, a blister rubbed open, the air still hot and sticky even as the dawn made a pink stain in the sky. He would unearth the coffin, go into the church, call the police and tell them what he'd found. The police would say, "Oh yes, thank you for calling, we have the mother right here." They would bring the mother over in their car, her eyes like draining holes in her broad face. But when Toro prized the coffin open, he hadn't used that many nails, she would understand. As terrible as her son's fate had been, Toro had, in his small way, tried to ease the pain of it. He pictured the boy's mother kissing her son's face, running her hand over the boy's thin shoulders, touching the scarf with which Toro had dressed him, turning her eyes to meet Toro's, acknowledging in that gaze their mutual love for the boy. By now it was light out. If he was lucky, if he kept running, this could all be over before the pastor showed up at the office. 2 blocks from the church, a big dog ran down the center of the street, a twist of red and black and green trailing from his mouth, and Toro broke into a run, a cry, understanding. He had forgotten about the dogs. There were scores of dogs, newly feral, that had been abandoned to the streets when people left Dayton. During the short times, abandoned dogs had been a problem too, but now the situation was worse because most members of the containment squad were volunteers from the southern, the wealthier suburbs, and a disproportionate number of those people had found a way out of town. Toro had heard that the containment people now simply shot dogs in the street. As Toro ran now, he cursed himself for not making the coffin stronger, for not burying it deeper, and he begged God again and again to let the boy's body be intact. He was so worried about the dogs, he never imagined police cars and a van outside the church. He didn't notice the horde of people, some in uniform, in the garden. "Who is this? Why are they here?" Turo thought when an arm stopped him. Then, even worse, he spotted the pastor. "Turo," the pastor called, lifting his hands in the air, "do you know anything about this?"